And this evening's talk, of course, as was mentioned, this is the last Friday night talk where I'll be here. I talked Ajahn Bamali into coming next Friday to give the very last Dhamma talk of the season. Even though we're doing an entry to the rains ceremony on Sunday, the real rains retreat starts just on the Sunday week. So anyway, so I'll get him to do some work. I was jealous of him because he was in quarantine for 14 days coming back from Sydney. So anyway, I missed out on quarantine this year. But for monks, we don't really call it a burden. We call it a free meditation retreat. Have a nice quiet time. It's interesting that whatever you do in life, you can always see some positive part of it. And that's one of the great things I see of life, is you can't change life, but you can always change your attitude towards it. If it's really, really cold, that's wonderful, because in the cold you don't get any flies or many ants crawling around. And you can always put on some rugs or something to keep yourself warm. And a lot of time, not many people like traveling when it's really cold. So I like the cold. And when it's very warm, I like the warm too. Because when it's nice and warm, you don't have to have the burden of lots of clothes and hats and other stuff you have to put on top of yourself. So I never think of what's wrong. You think, what's right with whatever happens in life? And when you get sick, as I mentioned many, many times, oh, you should never say there's something wrong with me, doctor. I'm sick. Your sickness is the way that your body reacts to things like infections or viruses or stuff. That's the way it heals. So, and you get many advantages of being sick. You can stay in your room and people feed you. You never get away with that when you're healthy. You don't have to go to work. You don't have to go and give a talk. It's been such a long time since I've been sick, isn't it? I'm always giving talks. But anyhow, you always see the positive side of things. But the talk for this evening, because this is the last talk of the season for me, I call it the last talk, it's not really the last talk, because what happens next is that people say, oh, have a lovely retreat, Ajahn Brahm, just go and meditate a lot and just do nothing. But you know this, how many monks down at Bodhinyana now?
I think you
say 23,
right?
23. Who's going to look after them? Who's going to teach them? That's my job. So I still give talks, but to the monastic community. And my job is to give them really nice talks, let them really understand meditation. You know, meditation is such an easy thing to do. I can't understand why people don't sort of do lots and lots of it. It's doing nothing. Isn't that a wonderful thing to do nothing? Would you like to do nothing? Spend 3 months doing nothing? What a wonderful thing. Because, oh, but you don't know how to do nothing, do you? You're all very good at doing things, but doing nothing is something you either feel guilty about or you don't know how to really get into it. Really just really enjoy and really just allow nothing to take over. Nothing is an amazing part of life. I didn't know what I was going to talk about tonight, but I'm going to talk tonight about nothing. I'm going to start with one of the old stories, which I loved this story because it was one of these unexpected moments, but physical, so you can understand it. You know, a lot of times you can tell sort of intellectual stuff, spiritual stuff, the four this, the five that, the six something else, and all that, the seven like Seven, Magnificent Seven, wasn't it? Or something, a movie long time ago. Seven Samurai, that was it. But no, instead of all this number stuff, and some of you don't like mathematics, and so is this an arithmetic class, a dhammaloka? No, it's not an arithmetic class. But I like getting into like stories, because in a story that can really reveal so much more information. And that was a story of when I went down into Guatemala when I was young. Somebody was asking me about this, because you know, between finishing school and going to university, I had this amazing 9 months of free time. So I was really poor in London. This was in 1968, 69. Got a job, earned a little bit of money, and then went over first of all. Would you believe it? If you can imagine this, in those days, I had lots of hair, big hair out to here. And where the hair finished, that's where my beard started. And it was called it was like a donut look, just a hole in the middle. And I had my guitar. Yeah, I did. And a little backpack, and I went hitchhiking over North Africa. Pretty adventurous thing to do. Must have driven my mother sort of crazy, but I was actually a very responsible young man. And then after that, went over to the United States on this 9 months free time, backpacking. But the most nicest thing about that was you go to the United States, and it was just like UK, it was just like Europe, it was just no real difference. And I really just wanted to experience more about life. So I went down to Central America, and that was really cool. It's the first time I went into rainforests. I remember I'd always seen in these pictures in the library books about these pyramids in the middle of the jungles of the Yucatan Peninsula in Guatemala or the southeast Mexico. And I always wondered what they were there for. The civilization had disappeared before the Spanish came in. So no one knew exactly what they were up to. And that was brilliant. It's one of the reasons why I don't like to have or give too much intellectual knowledge. Allow people to go to these experiences in the mind and experience it for yourself. So you're not told what to believe, which means your mind is free to paint the picture for itself. And so anyway, I eventually found my way to this big pyramids in the Yucatan Peninsula. The first place I went to was this place called Tikal. And it took days to get there. I've got to tell you something about the story of how I got there, because otherwise what happened there won't make sense. It was a very great spiritual moment for me when this happened. But actually to get there, from Guatemala City, and this was in 1969, so nothing much was there. It was an old city, but there was nothing much with infrastructure like trains or anything. I got an old bus to get to the port city on the Caribbean coast. I remember even there, you were stopped by the army. The bus was stopped. All the males had to get out, and there was a machine gun trained on you. Because, there was insurrection somewhere in the jungle there. And when I got out, I didn't know whether I was going to be able to get back in again afterwards, or whether I'd be shot to pieces. These days, it's very boring being a monk, but in those days, it was exciting. and then from the coast, on the Guatemalan coast, the only way to go further was get a fishing boat. And this was one time when I learned about just why sometimes people are dull when you meditate. When you meditate a lot, you get sort of tired and sleepy. No, I hadn't slept all night when you got this fishing boat early in the morning, about 1 o'clock in the morning, to get you on the next leg of the journey. And you saw the sun come up over the Caribbean in the morning. It was in 1969, and that was absolutely breathtaking. The beautiful dawn, the rise of the morning sun. and reds and golds and purples streaking over the Caribbean Ocean. Wow. And there's no way I could fall asleep. It was too beautiful. And that's one of the reasons why, when we meditate, you notice at the very beginning, I ask you to please notice how delightful your body is when it gets relaxed. And how delightful peace is. How delightful just being in this moment is. The more delight you have, and delight is there, it's a beautiful thing to have, like peace, being inside, not a problem in the world, because you let go of the past, where all the past problems live. You let go of the future, where all those fears live. It's like you're free of all of this. Ah, it's gorgeous. And once you delight in it, you stay there. And you get lots of energy and lots of stillness. It's a nice place to be. That's why doing nothing, that's what happens. Doing nothing needs a PA makeover. And it's a beautiful thing to do. And it's also very good for you as well. Because I always notice that, you know, just whenever I feel tired or I feel sick, I do feel sick sometimes, but I don't know what to do. I don't go to the doctor. That's just too much busyness. Please excuse me, doctors who are here. I know some people have been trying to get me to go to the doctor for years. But instead of going to the doctor, just go inside. We know how to relax the body and get all this joy coming up. Oh my goodness, that is so healing. Do that so often. You just go inside and just get lots of energy. And it just relaxes all the body. Things get eased and all this energy goes to the right places. I remember this, I've just, not my own experiences this time, about teaching on retreats. And sometimes, you know, when people do lots of meditation, they just want to ask somebody, what's happening? You have some weird experiences sometimes on retreats, all good stuff. But this was a time, this woman, she was, a couple of experiences here, that she was meditating and somebody tapped me on the shoulder and said, Ajahn Brahm, open your eyes, please. This is emergency. This is really important. And she showed me one of the meditators in the back. And this lady, she was twisted around. She was contorted. You know, sometimes I like to demonstrate, you know, what I'm talking about, but I can't demonstrate that, otherwise you'd have to take me to hospital. She was really twisted, extremely. And of course, you know, thank you for letting me know this. You know, what's going on? And so after the meditation, you know, I sort of asked her, come over here a minute. I said, well, what's wrong? And I said, did you realize when you were meditating, you were really twisted and a lot? And then she answered, she said, oh really? I never felt a thing. And that's when stupid Ajahn Brahm, this sort of, I understood what was going on. You know what I asked? I said, oh, when did you have your traffic accident? And she looked at me, I never told you that. At last, it's proof. Ajahn Brahm does have psychic powers. Hallelujah. And I said afterwards, no, it's not psychic powers. It's just the understanding of how your body and mind work together. I said, the reason you were twisted around like that, you know, when you were getting still, when you're stopping controlling your body, you let the body do what it needed to do, was that you probably had a very, very bad accident. And the most common bad accidents these days are car accidents. He said, you probably have a very terrible, he said, yeah, I came really close to dying. Been in the hospital many times, but you know, he said, this is your body doing its healing. You need to twist around like that in order to open those channels of energy so they could get to where they were needed. You probably feel wonderful now. And he said, yeah, I never felt so relaxed in my back for days, for months. And it's stories like that which tell me just how your body has ways of healing itself if you don't get scared and just worried about it, let it happen. And that's certainly what I always do. whenever there's any sickness in the body, I try to not to do anything about it, but to not do it. To relax to the max and let the energy go to where it's needed. And you know, that was an extreme case, but I know that many other cases when people meditate, you get into a nice deep meditation. I don't mean to, you know, jhana, you see beautiful lights and stuff. You get peaceful enough. What happens is you get what I call like hot spots in your body. Parts of your body are much warmer than is normal, as usual. And if that really happens, again, that's healing going to that place. And so often you get little hot spots there. Don't be afraid, just relax even more and let that hot spot stay there as long as you like. It's amazing just how afterwards you find there may be a tumor there or sort of something happening. People have some weird illnesses. And of course, that's what I ask them to do when they have these weird illnesses. I've never heard them before. Like the one which comes up now, this guy in Penang, he's a Malaysian gentleman. And he told me how he had this terrible disease, a very rare disease, where the best way he could describe it is things in the brain were all tangled up, physically tangled. And he said he had one operation for that, and it was really painful and very sort of unpleasant. But he went through it and he thought it was cured. It was very, very rare. And then when later on he had some aches and pains in his brain, in his skull, then they said again that it's reoccurred. It's very, very rare that it reoccurs, but it's back again. They showed him the CT scans. And he was really scared because you've been through these terrible operations once, you don't want to go through them again. He said, what am I going to do? And so I told him about meditating properly and just relax, don't be afraid. Don't try and cure it, but care for it. That's sort of the trick there. When you try and cure things, you get tense with it. When you care for it, you just allow it to be really relaxed and at ease. And so he did that. And I think straight after what was supposed to be the operation, he came back up to Penang, I think, just to see me and just to thank me. He said, what happened? He said, they took the CT scan again, you know, just before the second operation, and they said the words to him, sir, I'm sorry to say this, but there's something wrong with the CT machine. The CAT scan, we have to do it again. And they put him through the CT scan again and realized nothing wrong with the machine. It's something they didn't expect. Whatever the disease was, scrambling up some of the stuff in his brain, had actually unscrambled, and he was perfectly healthy again. So what the heck is going on? They've never seen that before. He did that sort of procedure in Singapore. And this is just one example of many, like people who just do amazing things when you allow the body to relax and basically heal itself. But anyway, going back to Central America, I do go off track sometimes, many thousands of miles. But in those days, you know, to get us all over on trucks, on fishing boats, and just going through the jungles. This was against 1969, and that part of the world was not developed at all. And just going through the rainforest, it was a real rainforest. Just, you know, with jungle on either side. And there's a sort of thing you'd expect. I really expected any moment Tarzan to go swinging out of the jungle. Going, ah! Whatever Tarzan does these days. But I also remember just getting one of the most beautiful breakfasts I've ever had. Just on these little bamboo and thatch restaurants on the side of the river, no roads or no cars or electricity or anything like that there. And I don't know if any of you like Mexican food, but this is like poor Mexican food. And it was just, you know, the chapatis, it was beans, black beans, and a cup of coffee. So simple, but it was just so nutritious, you know, dogs running around and nothing else. And I always remember the simplicity. That's also what I love, like simplicity. It's so tasty. Sometimes we put too much stuff in food, too much stuff in everything these days, too many things in our houses. And it just loses the sense of houses are for people, not for things. Oh, I'm just wandering off here again. First time I was in Thailand, in the northeast, this was a remote part of Thailand, no electricity, obviously no TV or anything. And going into the houses in northeast Thailand in the evening to do some Buddhist ceremony. And I went into the village with a few other monks. You could see that every house on the little road going into where we were going to do a ceremony, they had an upstairs veranda, same like in Cambodia as well, exactly the same. And upstairs and underneath was where the water buffalo lived. And the whole family lived up top. And they used to meet every evening. And there was a light there. The light was like a kerosene lamp. It was just a bowl of kerosene and a rag which they poked through the top of a toothpaste tube. You know, that made a nice wick. And they lit that and it just floated in the kerosene oil and created a light, but also created smoke, which kept the mosquitoes away. It's very, very efficient. But the most compelling part of that memory was to seeing the whole family sitting around that single light. Grandparents, grandmas, aunties, uncles, the fathers and mothers and their brothers and sisters and the little kids as well. And every evening they sit like that, nothing else to do, telling stories, some true, probably mostly made up. But they were together every evening, just sharing their time together. And when I saw that, I thought, my childhood was abusive. We had a TV. I wish we hadn't have had that. It was nice and simple, people talking together and learning the beautiful social skills of just laughing and talking and being with one another. So, you know, some of those simple things of life, try and recreate that in monasteries, but it's hard. But anyway, just going through those rivers and eventually finding your way to these old ancient archaeological sites. And there's hardly anybody there, because it's just too hard to get to right in the middle of the jungle. And what you saw there was these huge pyramids. Now, of course, I just turned 18. 18 at the time, fit, healthy. People sometimes don't believe that, but I was fit and healthy and thin and handsome and young years ago. But anyway, so what do? You want to climb one. And there's no one there to stop you. Because I think there's one archaeologist there, but that's about all I saw. Lots of monkeys and other animals and stuff, but only one other human I think I saw. And so to climb up, it's a long way up. What happened when you got to the top of that pyramid? There's no guidebooks or anything to tell you, what it was all about. There's no shops or anything. But what I did when I got to the top there, that was amazing. Because I had no information, I wasn't told what those things were supposed to mean. It was obvious what they were for. Because at the top there's a little, little hut, little room. But what was so impressive was when you got to the top, you were above the tree line of the jungle. You could see the horizon in all directions. There was nothing, this is why the nothing thing comes in, there was nothing between you and infinity in all directions. You just look and see the horizon stretching way beyond what you could reach. It was a sign of letting go, of nothing. And why it is that priests, experts, monks, nuns, sometimes stand in between you and the infinite. We try to explain it to you. Explanations are not needed, you just got to get someone to get up on top of that pyramid and see beyond your world. See beyond what you've experienced, what you've known, what you've been taught. See emptiness in all directions. Nothing there, no gods, no priests, no nothing. And that was probably one of the first times you experienced the spiritual profundity and depth and inspiration of something like nothing. And that's one of the reasons why that you revere nothing. We put so much stuff on the shrines. Wouldn't it be wonderful just to have nothing at all on that shrine? Totally empty. What would you do? You put something on it. Even a sign, don't put anything on here. That's putting something on it. What do they do when they got this beautiful... Have you been mountaineering? Okay, there wasn't that big mountains over in UK where I grew up, but I went up many of those mountains. You know what they do when you have mountains, you get to the top of the mountain and someone's put a flag up there. Or they put a bunch of rocks up there and they carve on there. My old lay name before was Peter Betts. Peter Betts was here. What do you want to say that for? So instead, to really respect like a mountain, isn't it best to leave it alone? Because what usually happens, you start with putting a flag there. The next thing you put up there is a coffee shop which sells souvenirs. Well, that's really terrible if you get to the top of the mountain and you find out there's a big coffee shop up there and a cable car on the other side of the road which takes you straight up. Why is that not... I really objected to that because sometimes... Why do we need all that stuff? Can't we just respect emptiness and nothing and this beautiful nature where nothing is disturbing it? Just as it was centuries ago, millennia ago. We don't add to it, we don't take it away because it's perfect as it already is. We don't try and cure it. We care for it. It's one of the reasons why that... When you're announcing it's coming on to one of my birthdays soon. Sometimes people always ask me, what do you want, Ajahn Brahm? Can we give you a gift? I've served you, looked after you, been kind to you for such a long time. Do you want to give me something? And a few people have got the message. You know what they do? They get a nice little box. They wrap it up and give it to me. And when I open the box, you know what's inside of it? Nothing. Ah, that's just what I wanted. How did you know? And it's beautiful, just the nothing, the emptiness of life. But anyway, going up that pyramid, you can see what it would have been like. You know, for someone who never had a TV, never had schooling, never had read books, never went to a church or a temple or a mosque or anywhere. And they were taking up the temple for the very first time as a young man or a young woman. That's what I imagined, standing on top of that pyramid, not being told what to do and when to come down, I just was enjoying myself. Freedom. Time was not important. And just... doing stuff was not important. There's no rules up there. There's nowhere else to go except just to look all around. And just being up there and feeling also the coolness. Because in the jungle, if you've been in jungle rainforests, it's very close and very damp and there's hardly any wind goes through, lots of insects like mosquitoes and stuff. You go up the top there, because it's above this tree line, you get the winds blowing. It was so refreshing up there. No mozzies. It's nice and clean air. And it was just, nothing was there. And I loved that. That was really a religious experience. Imagining if I had just been a young kid, going up there for the first time, seeing infinity for the first time. What is infinity? Nothing between you and infinity, direct contact. So little by little, you appreciated the simplicity. But it's hard to be simple in this world, because when you have nothing, people want to give you something. Put stuff on the shrine, put stuff on the mountain tops, build retreats in the desert. Let the desert be free, nothing there. So little by little, you understand that nothing is very profound. So profound, when people ask you, all these years of being a monk, what have you attained? If you say nothing, some people will just be upset at you. Say, what have you been doing all this time? Just lazing around, sleeping all the time? Oh, crack. Now, instead of nothing, nothing you can't contain, you can't put in a box, really, real nothing. Nothing is free. Nothing is something you can't own. Nothing is something which, again, is around everybody. Have you ever noticed when you walk into this room, this hall, many of you have been here, well, every Friday for weeks, months, years, I don't know. When you come in this room, what do you see? You see Buddha statue, carpets, people, you see monks, nuns, whatever, you see the walls, you see the lights, you see things. We've been conditioned by our upbringing to only notice things. But have you noticed the biggest thing in this room is the space between us all? What surrounds us? And it never separates us. It's what joins us together. It's around you as it's around me. The emptiness in this room, the nothingness in this room. And that's really hard to notice and hard to preserve, because we've always been conditioned, brainwashed, learned how to notice things rather than how to notice nothing. The space between people rather than the people themselves. And of course, you know where this is going. The space between your thoughts rather than the thoughts themselves. This is an old meditator's trick, but I love doing it. The first time I did this was in Singapore, in a big hall, about 3,000 people. And people said, oh, we can't meditate. We've got two busy minds. These are executives, business people. It's very tough in Singapore to get by and to make a dollar and to keep the dollar and whatever else they're trying to find and keep. Said, well, we can't meditate. It's a waste of time. Ooh. Ooh. That's another thing, which there's always noise around. Or is there? Can you hear the space between the noises? That's amazing. After a while, you find that so delightful. And that's actually in this little exercise I did for these Singaporeans, 3,000 of them. Simple, just ask them to please be aware, when I'm speaking, you always, you know, listen to what I say, but also there's a reaction to what I say. Sometimes I say something stupid, and, oh yeah, I've heard that one before. Oh yeah, that's not very smart. Oh, I don't agree with that. You have a reaction in your mind. But now, what is a reaction in your mind as I'm speaking now? Because you will start to notice. many gaps between my words. In those spaces, what was happening inside? Nothing was happening. And it felt so peaceful. It felt profound. And you know, that was the first time many of those 3,000, they were business people, first time they experienced some silence, stillness, peace. There it was again. So simple, isn't it? Now, see if you can remain still for half an hour. If you notice its beauty and its joy, its good qualities, it's so easy to stay there. You don't need to give it a name. You don't need to try and capture it. Peace is very shy. If you mention her name, she runs away. They never love to be captured. They'll escape at the first opportunity. You know peace. You can't own it. These are little things which you feel. That's why doing nothing should be the most easiest thing in the world to do. And people say, how do I do nothing? You know, we feel guilty if we don't do something. Why? So, sometimes it's a weekend. I don't know what you're doing tomorrow. Can you have even an afternoon free to do nothing? Sit in your garden, if you've got a garden, or a veranda, if you've got a veranda somewhere, and see how difficult it is to do nothing. Because, I say the first person, I made a simile up years ago, the first person sits in their garden or sits on the veranda, okay, I'm doing nothing. So they get up a book and read this. And that's not doing nothing, reading a book. Oh, okay, sorry. So they put the book away and they're looking at their garden. And we're thinking, oh, that bush over there, that needs to be pruned. And that flower there, that bed needs to be watered. That's doing stuff, planning it. See if you can just sit there and say, even though the flower bed does need watering, even though the lawn needs raking, even though the tree is almost falling over, not now. The only time you can really do nothing is in this present moment. Because right now it's already here, and it's perfect enough. You just let it be. People say, how do we let things be? Do nothing. How do you do nothing? Just let it be. It has to have some trust. That's my job, is trying to sell the product. I remember I actually get into trouble doing that, like selling nothing. Can you sell nothing? Encourage it so you can appreciate its beauty and its benefit. Sometimes, if you tell that to the people you live with, you say, you know, well, what are you doing just sitting on the veranda there? You say, I'm doing nothing. Oh, great, can you please come and help me? Because nothing is not appreciated these days. So that's why those of you who've been on meditation retreats with me, you know the little tricks. If your like husband or your wife or your friend or someone says, what are you doing there? If you just say doing nothing, that doesn't really cut the ice with them. So you say, I'm watching the trees grow. Trees do grow, you know. And you've got to really watch them for a long time before you see them grow. It's just a good excuse to learn how to do nothing. And it's very healthy for you. We know how to do things. We're very good at doing things. And what happens when we do things? A lot of time we make a big mess of things. You don't know how to do it. I know how to do it. You do it the wrong way. I do it the right way. If you don't do anything at all, you can't make mistakes. See what it's like having a weekend, a day off. How many times have you had a day off? Probably never since you were born. Always doing something. So see if you can know the art of doing nothing, of relaxing, letting peace come inside of you. That's all there is, peace and stillness. Sometimes people feel that you're going to go asleep, but that doesn't happen. As I said, real peace is very beautiful and delightful. It's like a diamond, it glistens. That's the same with the peace. It's so beautiful, delightful, you can't take your eyes off it. It's gorgeous, and you can feel its effect on your body and on your mind. Freeing, relaxing. How does your mind feel? A lot of times it's just tight and tense. I know that feeling as well, because I'm a senior monk, I have to do lots and lots of stuff. And just, you know, recently just arranging stuff for people coming on quarantine, starting the range retreat soon. There's so much stuff to do. But I also got my cave over in Bodhinyana Monastery. That's one thing which is open for inspection on the opening to the rains day. Go see my cave. And it's, I know the reason why I love that cave, because it's silent inside. It's underground, it's monk-built cave, it's a very comfortable cave, it's like a five-star cave, it does have electricity, I've got to admit, and a cork floor, a cork tile floor. But when you go inside, you can't hear a thing. I often say the monks might be going crazy outside, I don't care, because inside you can't hear anything. And it's silent and it's dark. Everything gets so peaceful there, there's nothing in there. So little by little you learn just how to respect nothing. You know, these days we have Buddha statues on the shrine. In those early days, they never had Buddha statues. They're like an empty seat or a footprint, but no Buddha was there. Why? Because it was just showing just the power of like emptiness, nothing being there, things vanishing and disappearing. And how beautiful and how inspirational that was. And because it was beautiful, if you really appreciate nothing, then what happens? It becomes incredibly powerful. And you know where you can go to sleep or get tired when the mind is just paused in the stillness of nothing. That's one of the reasons why, oh my goodness, I keep going on. That's one of the reasons why one of the deepest teachings, or probably the deepest teachings, which Ajahn Chah gave to me years ago, just talking about this the other day at Monk's Monastery. And, you know, your teacher, you always try and look after them. But, you know, sometimes you can overlook, you can look after them too much, which is one of the reasons, you know, sometimes I reject. I say, this is enough. Because the example there, okay, here we go, if you don't remember this one, was on one talk, this is quite a few years ago, here at Dhammaloka Center in Nolomara, I coughed. And then I saw a couple of people go out, and they came back in. At the end of the talk, they said, I've just been to the shop to get this medicine for you. It's really important. I don't want you to have a cough. That's very nice of you. He said, you will take it. I said, okay. They put it down there. And then someone else got another medicine. Oh, this is homeopathic medicine. It's really, really good. It really helped me. You will take it, won't you? They put it down there. Then someone got some herbal medicines. And someone got some Ayurvedic medicines. Someone got some allopathic medicines. Someone got some psychopathic medicines.
I don't know.
There's so many types of medicine. And I was stupid enough at that time. I said, okay. Well, they gave it to me. You can't just disappoint them by not taking it. Oh, exactly, yes. Then I was really sick. But sometimes, you've got really nice hearts, but sometimes caring for people too much. But anyway, so when Ajahn Chah got sick, instead of actually, it wasn't really about caring for him. That was part of it. But he was my teacher. So we built a sauna for him in this monastery. Now, saunas, you may think, were created in Sweden or somewhere. But you know that saunas were mentioned as a general building in the monasteries in the time of the Buddha. It was one of the buildings they had there. Fire rooms, they called it, saunas. So, you know, it was invented in India a long time before it got to North America, North Europe. So anyway, we read that. One of the nice things about being a Western monk, it's easy to learn these languages like Pali, Sanskrit and stuff, because you've been trained like that to learn those languages. And then you read it yourself, and you're rebellious enough to say, hey, no one told me about that. It's there. See, it must be right. So we built one. I was involved in that. So we built a sauna for our teacher. I must admit, I didn't spend too much time in there because I was English. But those German monks, they made it so hot in there. I don't know why. But anyhow, so Ajahn Chah would go in there. And he would go in there once a week. It wasn't just, you know, to look after him, you know, just like the love and care for someone who taught you. But he would come every week and give us a talk. It was just a means to get him to come in. So if you want me to give a talk, Hokchin, if you want me to give a talk in Dhammaloka during the rains retreat, one, make sure I'm sick. Number two, make a sauna here. But no, I'm only joking. But what happened once, like these talks which are given, especially by great monks like Ajahn Chah, my teacher in Thailand, you know, some of those talks are so boring. And I'm being honest, being totally respectful, but honest. Sometimes I go on and on and on and on and on. Same old stories I've heard before. But sometimes, you know, sometimes you just hit the spot. And when a monk like an Ajahn Chah really hits the spot, wow, that's just so inspiring. And this time, he gave this talk, and it was really one of the most magnificent talks. You're inspired, uplifted, and just really blissing out. So when he went after the talk to go to his sauna, I just went around the back of the hall and just sat there meditating for a couple of hours. Oh, it's just beautiful meditation. Because inspiration, that's one of the best ways to get deep meditation. A nice talk, allow the joy and the happiness to come in. You feel, wow, this is really good. You just want to cross your legs and close your eyes and do nothing. You don't have to do anything. The mind is just going in that direction. Just don't impede it. Let it go. And it goes deep in inside. When I came out of my meditation, oh, just lots of happiness inside. I don't know if I've told this story at Dhammaloka before. The monks know it very well. But when I came out of the meditation, I was just really walking on air. You do after a good meditation, mind really clear. I thought, I should see if I can do anything for my teacher. So I went walking towards the sauna. I was too late. He'd already finished. He was walking in the opposite direction. And as he was walking towards me, I saw him. He stopped and he looked at me. Now, sometimes, you know, you're not really supposed to talk about like weird stuff, like psychic powers and stuff. But I don't mind saying this about Ajahn Chah. This was a time I just walked into, I had a very clear mind. And you could actually, you know, you may sort of think I'm stupid here, but this is true. You could feel him, as it were, going inside your mind, reading me. Weird, I can't explain how else it feels, but you know, just he was inside, checking me out. And for once in my life, I didn't mind, because my mind was pretty pure after deep meditation. So there, come in, check me out. You know what it's like? You know, if everything in your room is nice and clean when your mother comes to check on you, or you got all your sort of your stuff done at work when the sort of boss comes and said, how's it going? You feel, you know, oh yeah, come and have a look. Yeah, look at my mind. Then afterwards, he looked at me. It's really, it's weird to say, but fierce, but kind. Bravo, Ongso.
Sorry.
Sorry about that. Brahma Wangsa, that's a full name. Ajahn Brahm, that came later on in my life. You know, Brahma Wangsa is a very long name. So out of kindness, you know, just shorten it to Brahm. It's a much easier name, much more cuddly. But it does have its bad side effects. And one of those bad side effects, I'll go back to Ajahn Chah's story in a moment. And one of those bad side effects was I gave a talk in Mercedes College in Perth. Anyone here from Mercedes College went to school there? You did, okay. Hope this wasn't you, but it's a Catholic girls' school. And so I went to give a talk there on Buddhism, just, you know, one afternoon and just, you know, quite a few classes. And the following day, I don't know exactly what business I had in St. George's Terrace, walking down the road there, but I was walking, doing something or other, and then saw these Mercedes schoolgirls walking the opposite direction. And we're going to cross, you know, cross paths. And they looked at me and said, hey, you were the monk who gave a talk at our school yesterday. And I said, wow, you still remember me? He said, oh yeah, we'll never forget you. I thought, ah, how nice that is. And I was really warmed by, you know, like 13, 14-year-old schoolgirls saying nice things to you, you know, it was really quite pleasing. Yeah, you know, won't forget me. No, we'll never forget anyone who's called Ajahn Brah. I said, there's an M on the end. I thought that was very funny. I wasn't insulted. I thought, yeah, okay, good one. I can use that in my talk, because I've been using my talks for many, many years now, Ajahn Brah. But anyway, just with Ajahn Chah, he looked at me and Bamba Wangso. And the next thing he said was, why? And that comes from a teacher you respect enormously. And I realized that what he was trying to do, he'd obviously gone inside, checked me out, and realized I had a very deep meditation, which was true. And so he tried to help me become enlightened, basically. Why? And I replied, I don't know. I was a stupid young man. I don't know. But one of the lovely things with being in that tradition, when you made a stupid reply, did anything stupid, that teacher would never criticize you, would never sort of hit you or anything. He just thought it was just so incredibly funny. He burst out laughing. I always think that's one of the reasons why he had lots of Western monks, because we created so much humor for him. Some of the things we do. So anyway, he laughed, but then he stopped laughing. He looked at me and he said, I will tell you the answer. If anyone ever asks you again the question, why? This is the answer. You can imagine how excited you get. It's only just Ajahn Chah and myself on the path. No one else was around. Oh, it was the driver, I think, the Thai man was around. And he said, the answer to the question, why, for one of the greatest monks. And he said, the answer to the question why was, my me arai. That's Thai. And my me arai means, there's nothing. There's nothing. That's the answer. Then he looked at me and said, Bama Wangso, with lots of kindness, do you understand? I said, yes, yes. And he said, no, you don't.
I was really high one moment, right down on the ground in the pits next moment, no, you don't. And then he walked off laughing.
But it was a very beautiful interchange. And I mentioned it many times in my life, and I always remember it as well. Why? There's nothing. For those of you who want to study deeper, it's called anatta, non-self, whatever you want to call it. Sunyata, nothingness. Just like that beautiful nothingness on the top of the pyramid. Nothing between you and forever. Infinite. Nothing. The answer to the question, why? Do you understand?
You know the usual answer. No, you don't. That's why you have to come next week to listen to Ajahn Brahmali. Thank you all for listening. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Okay, please excuse me for indulging, as usual. I enjoy myself. Okay, any questions from the floor here? Yeah. Okay.
Ajahn, if yes. There's nothing, why build more retreat center?
Nothing. Why retreat more center? To create more sweet nothings in the world. Yeah. Okay, next question. Okay, yeah. There's questions, aren't there? Here we go. Wow, that's a lot for nothing. Yeah, enough, okay. From Singapore. I have a lot of doubt and worry as well as low self-esteem. Keep agonizing over rethinking, doubting decisions made, changing them, especially the life path vocation I am on. Any advice, please? Like doubt, making decisions, that's a very easy thing to do. I think I mentioned this recently, didn't I? Last week, when I was in Oslo, I just tossed a coin. Because that's when somebody asked me. The woman asked me, said, no, got difficult, and this is not a joke, Ajahn Brahm, she said, don't say that to me, because it doesn't work. So I got a very difficult decision in life, life-changing. Oh, how should I make that decision? And then I looked at her and said, well, suppose it is, should I marry that boy sitting next to me? I didn't know them. Never seen them before in my life. And she just put her heads in her hands. So that was the decision she was trying to make. You know, that's an important decision in life. You know, you don't know really whether it's going to work out or not. You can try your very best. And she was agonizing over that. Should I marry him or should I not marry him? So it's so easy. Take a coin, heads I marry him, tails I don't. Why not? People think, Ajahn Brahm is crazy. But the point was, you're making those decisions, heads I marry him, tails I don't. When you do that, it comes up, say tails, I don't. How do you feel? How do you react? Inside you think, yes, thank you, coin. Or do you think, 2 out of 3? So all the tossing the coin is doing is revealing how you feel inside. Getting that intuition to come up instead of your thinking. Because too often we rely on our thoughts, which are often just distorted by fear or by want or all sorts of other silly things. The intuition is much more pure. It goes deeper where places like fear can't reach. You know what to do. And this reveals it. Comes up heads, marry him. Yes. It means that's what you really wanted to do in the first place. But the other thing which I say, people think I'm crazy, I've never been married, that probably explains all this stupid stuff I say. But the other thing which I say is that it doesn't matter that much what decision you make. What is really crucial is what you do after you've made that decision. In other words, if you decide to follow that path, put all your energy into making it work. So, doing a new business. Look, a good example, like going out of this room here, turning left or turning right, which one do you want to go? You find out the path always leads back in a circle, goes the other side. It doesn't really matter whether you go out the left door or the right door. What is really important is what you do after you made that decision to make sure you don't wear yourself out making decisions. You save the energy to after you made the decision to make it work. In my experience, life is almost anything you can make work. But a lot of times you make the decision and use all our energy, should I not? And once you made the decision, you're too tired to make it work. Your low self-esteem. It's wonderful if you're a Buddhist, you know there's no self anywhere. So have I got high self-esteem, low self-esteem? I've got no self-esteem. I esteem my no self. That's why if you ever go on a retreat, at places like Jhana Grove meditation retreat, we've got like two lines for people to get their food. One is for the enlightened ones. That's no self service. The ones who aren't enlightened yet, you have to go self-service. Sorry, I'm going to carry on and finish quickly. When a decision has been made, it's made. Let it go, for goodness sake. That's why I always say that there's this word which somebody told me about the infinite, about the ground of all being, about just essential reality, about God or Nibbana or whatever they wanted to call it. They called it the ineffable. Have you heard that, the ineffable? Has anyone ever explained what it means? Like life is ineffable. The origin of the universe is ineffable. The ultimate reality is ineffable. It means you can't eff it. It's ineffable. I don't know what you mean by effing something, but I know one I know one interpretation of that, and I'm not going to say it. But I thought that was a very useless word. So I wanted to change that word from ineffable to ineffable. That's a really useful word, ineffable. The past is ineffable. If you'd have married somebody else, what would it have been like? Better, worse? Who knows? If you hadn't got that job you did, if you hadn't come here this evening, and you'd gone to watch the TV or something, what would your life have turned out like? If. The past is ineffable. The future is ineffable. I love that idea because it means you're so free of all just wasting your energy in your brain. Just, you know, trying to think, oh, I should have done something else. Oh, I shouldn't have done this. Oh, I shouldn't have done... Anyway, next question. Victor Chan from US. Is there a Buddhist viewpoint on the COVID vaccine? Is it a personal choice? Are we obligated to take the vaccine for the good of the community? Well, you may know, I've had my first AstraZeneca vaccine. The reason I wanted that was because it's got Zen in it, which is pretty Buddhist. That's Zen. Okay. I got my second next week, next Friday. Is it a personal choice? It's actually not a personal choice. I'm taking that because apparently once you get vaccinated, you go traveling again. I miss that, going overseas. And it's been such a long time since I've seen an aircraft from the inside. No, it's sometimes you look at your own body and mind. Does it do any harm to you? It's very, very rare that it does any harm to anybody. And it does apparently help people, so I'm taking it, so I don't know why other people don't take it. And also that I've noticed, I said this at Bodhinyana Monastery, I've noticed that all the people who go to Bodhinyana Monastery, not one of them has got COVID. So this is just, you know, just facts, statistics. It's there to be. No, anyway, so from a Buddhist point of view, compassion, why not? From Myanmar, I see many COVID deaths around me in countries around lockdown. Conflict is outside and within. How should I deal with all the suffering? Again, you have suffering there with COVID, but please look for the beauty. Some of the great sort of health workers on the front line, just how much they give and sacrifice themselves for others. That's inspiring. Sometimes when there is tragedies around the world, you can always find, if you look carefully enough, see great inspirations happening. Some people die and some people very close to you die as well. And people you've known for a long time. But that always happens all the time. People dying, tragedies, tsunamis. But why? And can't we see something beautiful there as well? For the tsunami, I'm going to tell the tsunami story now. This is the crocodile story. If you haven't heard this before, but this always inspires me. There was a gentleman who would, on the way to work every morning, was stopped by one of the lagoons. This was in Sri Lanka. And just take 3 or 4 slices of bread to give to the fish. And then one day when he did his usual routine on the way to work, just put 3 or 4 slices of bread for the fish, he saw there was something else there. It was a crocodile came as well. And he gave 2 pieces of bread to the crocodile as well. And that crocodile would come every morning to get some bread. And the crocodiles, you know, they can eat people. So anyway, this was going on for a while, and then one morning he had his bread. He didn't have time to feed the fishes and the crocodile because the big wave came, the tsunami. And it just got hold of him and washed him out into the ocean and basically out to sea. The currents were so strong. And he was struggling to try and keep afloat. And apparently he grabbed onto 1 or 2 pieces, I think one was a piece of furniture, a chair, to try and keep afloat, but the current was so strong that it would actually rip whatever he held away from him, and he's going further and further away from shore. And then he grabbed onto a log of wood. He could hold on to that, it was big enough and just sort of rough enough to keep a grip on it. And then there's utter confusion and fear, and he noticed that log of wood was actually going the opposite direction to everything else. Everything else was going further and further away from shore, and this log of wood was going closer to shore. And he didn't really figure out what it was because he was just so desperate to survive. When he got close enough to the bank, he could jump off the log of wood and climb up to the shore. And only then, when he looked, he saw it wasn't a log of wood. It was a crocodile. Now, why did that crocodile do that? Now, some people say, oh, maybe because he wanted some more bread the following day. Well, I don't think that's the case. You're kind to animals, and animals are kind to you. Even crocodiles. So I love that little story. So, you know, from tragedies, we sometimes get some amazing, inspiring stories. From Hong Kong, how do I overcome my wanting to settle old past stuff and find a solution to it? How do I let it go, settle it, find closure? Thank you and happy birthday. Okay, you know that old saying which I mentioned? I mentioned this last week because when I went down to Albany, someone had actually carved that into a nice piece of wood, and it was in my room where I was resting when I was in the Albany monastery. And that's the old saying, don't seek revenge, because karma will get the bastards anyway. Now, sometimes people criticize me. Ajahn Brahm, you shouldn't speak like that. Speak more polite. But do you remember it if I speak it polite? Of course you don't. You add a little bit of spice to the the words, and people remember it. And it's true, you're Buddhist. Karma will eventually make its way around. And sometimes you see the hardships, they must really suffer for that. So you don't need to settle old past stuff. Find a solution to it, you learn from it. Don't be so stupid next time to sort of marry a person like that. Check them out first of all. Or whatever it is. Or even better, don't get married at all. Become a monk or a nun, that's a wonderful lifestyle. Anyway, from Australia, dear Ajahn, during meditation I'm worried that I'm suppressing my thoughts instead of letting go. How do I tell the difference? If you're suppressing the thoughts, you can feel the tension in your mind and the fear that if you let go, those thoughts will come back. It's a totally different feeling. If you're letting go, it's so peaceful. Just there's not a thought there. You can come in if you want thoughts, they're not there. Suppression can only work temporarily, and it's not a real solution at all. You don't suppress anything. You realize that silence is more beautiful. Isn't it more beautiful than me speaking? Unfortunately, there's one more question. When monastics become too old to live independently in a monastery, what happens to them? Oh, we do have the voluntary euthanasia. Fortunately, that voluntary euthanasia is allowable now in birth. So it has to be voluntary. We just actually just talk to them and say, come on, do the right thing. No. What happens to them? Do they grow old and die in the monastery, or do they go to lay people's nursing home? Oh, crikey. Remember, I'm 70 next couple of weeks. Now, a lot of times that you can care for a person, and sometimes there's no way you'll do that. You look after people. And as I say, it's amazing the health you can get with good meditation. I'm not just saying this, you know, that I have been a very healthy monk for a long time now. Again, the only reason why I take those COVID medicines is just for travel, to prove it to other people. But there's something inside your meditation, it's very powerful. You just know how to look at your body and just, you know, leave me alone for a couple of hours and it's all gone. So that's one of the reasons why you take that medication. Too old to live independently in a monastery. It was one of the oldest people in the world, I think, was in Phuket. He was 114, that monk in Phuket. He was in his late hundreds. And, you know, he didn't have much, he wasn't running around or going on a surfboard in Phuket Beach. But he was just, you know, still fit and healthy. Would talk to people very clearly. It's interesting, old age, what is it? And sometimes, as long as your mind is clear and strong, which is what we do as especially monks and nuns, we really train our mind. You may think my tummy is fat, but that's only because we follow the middle way. But the mind is really fit and healthy. That's the most important part. When your mind is fit and healthy, then that governs everything else. So, they die in the monastery? Yeah, sometimes they die in the monastery, go to lay people's nursing home. No, I don't think I would do that. How old are you now, Venerable? 40. Only 40. No, we won't do that. Just learn to live peacefully and happily by yourself. You don't need much attention. But anyway, I've got it all worked out for when I die. Have you seen my cave where I live? So I'll just close the doors, bolt them, and just stay in there. So you won't know, is he alive? Is he dead? Or just suspended animation? And that'd be great, you know, to actually to raise funds for whatever you want to do, Mr. President. Ajahn Brahm doesn't disappear, doesn't go. He's still there. Or is he not there? He's gone to nothing. From nothing to nothing. Thank you for listening.
Very good.
That cave, you can't get in there. Once I lock the doors, there's no way you can get in there. You can't burrow from up top. You won't know. What a beautiful way. It's like a mausoleum. But it's already there. Okay, now what are we doing next? Oh yeah, we just bounce. We can't, don't we? Okay. And then we can go and do whatever you need to do. Any questions, you can come up afterwards if you really want to irritate me.
No, you can come and irritate me if you want.
Arahaṁ Sammā Sambuddho Bhagavā Buddhaṁ Bhagavantaṁ Abhivādhayami Suvakkato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammaṁ Namassāmi Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sango Sangang Namami.
Oops.